Sweet in the morning. Oh Lord, it's sweet in the morning.
Hello, my name is Bernard White, and this is Wake Up Call on Radio Justice. And I want to welcome you to this edition of Wake Up Call.
Sweet in the morning, 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 sweet in the morning.
On today's Wake Up Call, we'll take our usual excursion around the globe in search of significant information you might have missed, a mixture of old and new. I also want to introduce to you Majid Ali, an actual doctor with decades of experience as a pathologist and doctor of integrative medicine. Dr. Ali has a healing formula from which you may benefit. We will end today's program with a lecture given by the late black psychologist, Professor Amos Wilson. Dr. Wilson's topic is the ABCs of oppression.
Welcome to Science, Health, and Healing Library of Ali Academy. I'm Dr. Majid Ali. The subject of this video article is, should you say no to your diabetes drugs? This video article is part of a series where I raise this issue, should you say no to non-emergency coronary artery bypass operation? Should you say no to non-emergency coronary artery stent insertion? Should you say no to chemotherapy for cancer? Should you say no to radioablation of your heart's pacemaker, which means permanent destruction? And now, this article, should you say no to diabetes drugs? You know, there's only one person who can honestly answer this question for you, and that is you. That simple. You have to be honest with yourself if you want to answer this question. You have to first ask yourself, am I willing and able to learn what the real issues are? Why I need diabetes drugs to begin with? Second question, am I willing and able to tell myself that I want to make an agreement with myself to become my own primary doctor for the next 6 to 9 months to test the possibility that I can reverse my diabetes, and by that, I can get rid of my diabetes drugs? Third question, are you then willing and able to follow a program that I'd outlined? For me, reversal of diabetes is no surprise. Literally every second or third week of my working life, I see patients who were frankly diabetic. This program is also part of a series on insulin case studies. Recently, I saw a woman who had been on diabetic drugs for 17 years. I did an insulin test, 3-hour insulin. I found out that her peak insulin was 3 times as much as the insulin of healthy people who do not have diabetes. So clearly, the objective is that you clean the cell membrane, degrease the cell membranes, free up the insulin. Welcome. Welcome to Science, Health, and Healing Library of Ali Academy. I'm Dr. Majid Ali. The subject of this video article is, should you say no to your diabetes drugs? Should you say no to your diabetes drugs? This video article is part of a series where I raise this issue, should you say no to non-emergency coronary artery bypass operation? Should you say no to non-emergency coronary artery stent insertion? Should you say no to chemotherapy for cancer? Should you say no to radioablation of your heart's pacemaker, which means permanent destruction? And now, this article, should you say no to diabetes drugs? You know, there's only one person who can honestly answer this question for you, and that is you. That simple. You have to be honest with yourself if you want to answer this question. You have to first ask yourself, am I willing and able to learn what the real issues are? Why I need diabetes drugs to begin with? Second question, am I willing and able to tell myself that I want to make an agreement with myself to become my own primary doctor for the next 6 to 9 months to test the possibility that I can reverse my diabetes, and by that, I can get rid of my diabetes drugs? Third question, are you then willing and able to follow a program that I'd outlined? For me, reversal of diabetes is no surprise. Literally every second or third week of my working life, I see patients who were frankly diabetic. This program is also part of a series on insulin case studies. Recently, I saw a woman who had been on diabetic drugs for 17 years. I did an insulin test, 3-hour insulin. I found out that her peak insulin was 3 times as much as the insulin of healthy people who do not have diabetes. So clearly, the objective is that you clean the cell membrane, degrease the cell membranes, free up the insulin receptor protein embedded in the cell membrane so insulin can work. And if you do that, the person would lose weight, their blood sugar will come down, and they won't need the diabetes drugs. A1C test, which is a test which tells you what is the average blood sugar in the 3 months preceding the time of the test. That's an excellent test. It will give an excellent guidelines. Now, I do not recommend that you throw your diabetes drugs in the toilet. That is dangerous. That is irresponsible. And that is really totally against the spirit of Science, Health, and Healing Encyclopedia that I'm trying to develop here for authentic information for people all over the world, information untainted by corporate influences, authenticated by my patients and the laboratory tests, free for all people in the world, in an easy-to-access format, these video segments, easy to understand. I try not to throw a lot of technical terms just to impress you in my these video essays and articles. And of course, it's free for all. If this vision resonates with you, I hope it does, you will send me an email, tell me how we can expand and enhance this encyclopedia. My email is aliacademy7@gmail.com. aliacademy77 is the number @gmail.com. I return back to this short segment is really a philosophic invitation for you to consider being your own doctor. I have a book, Reversing Diabetes. You can download it in a digitized form at much less cost than the copy of the print volume. And you can do so by going to majidali.com. And if you go to that website, that will guide you how you can order this book, download it any part of the world in a digitized form. Of course, you can also order a print copy at the same website, majidali.com. Or you can send us an email and then the staff will return to you and will help you along. There are two chapters in that volume that I think everyone, every child should learn. I am challenging the entire profession of diabetes and the American Diabetic Association. There's one chapter where I say, please say no to fasting blood glucose. I'll give you many profiles. I'm a pathologist. I set very high standards for myself. I will not, for cheap thrills or for any temporary personal aggrandizement, put the health of other people in jeopardy. I believe that if you read that article, you will understand how unjust it has been for people to put you on diabetes drugs without doing insulin tests. Fasting blood sugar is very misleading. I think if the practice should be discontinued. There's another chapter about insulin toxicity. I think if you read that chapter, it will open your eyes. And if you read it a second time, you will then find it much easier and a far more intelligent, informed decision that you want to say, yes, Dr. Eliza inviting me to make an agreement with myself, to be honest with myself and ask myself these questions. Am I willing and able to learn these things? Am I willing and able to become a scientist for myself and put some of Dr. Ali's suggestions? There's an insulin reduction program. That's a short video essay on this Science, Health, and Healing Encyclopedia. I think there are more than 20 video articles on the issue of insulin toxicity, saying no to blood sugar. And there's one that you especially should watch. It's a brief segment on 7 stages of insulin toxicity. People waste insulin and they become insulin toxic for years before diabetes is diagnosed. And of course, all the diabetes drugs further increase insulin. And that further deepens the degrees of insulin toxicity. You need to understand these things. Otherwise, I don't like to talk about fear. Everyone knows that the commonest cause of blindness is amputation. Did you know New York Times told us back in 2007 that more amputations are done because of diabetes in New York City every year than in the entire Vietnam War as a result of war injuries? Just think about that. New York Times also told us that 1 out of every 2 children born in Hispanic families in New York City will become diabetic. 70% of Indian Americans in southwestern United States, Arizona, Pima Indians, they are now diabetic. And almost 90% of them also have hypertension, and about 70% of them are obese. And those are the three things which will take you, define the path to dialysis. Obesity, hypertension, and diabetes. Our vision at Science, Health, and Healing Encyclopedia is to provide you authentic information validated by my patients, untainted by corporate influences. And yes, I do have the courage to call a spade. I will tell you the truth. But remember, I'm not the healer. I'm inviting you to become your own healer. That's a higher calling. It's a lot easier to call a doctor and say, well, give me some pills and cure my diabetes. If the doctor promises you that, he's either a fool or he takes you for a fool. You decide. Initially, this path is harder. It forces you to be truthful to yourself. It forces you to assume responsibility for yourself. But then put yourself on this plan for 6 to 9 months and 12. And if you think that you want someone who can cure your diabetes, Science, Health, and Healing Encyclopedia is not the right place for you. I, Dr. Majid Ali, is not the right teacher for you. Nor am I the right doctor for you. Send me an email and tell me how we can expand and enhance this encyclopedia for people all over the world, free of cost. My email is aliacademy7@gmail.com. aliacademy7@gmail.com. Please take the time, look at several other video articles on this encyclopedia. I'm saying on this because these are all video articles. And especially those which are entitled, which begin with insulin toxicity, clinical features, causes, reduction, the diet for reducing insulin, how insulin damages your heart, your brain, your eyes, your nerves, sets the stage for memory problems, Alzheimer's disease. Do you know that there is no disease known to me, the degree of which is not worsened by diabetes? Please join me again until we meet again. May you be gracious and graceful and generous in your spirit. Thank you for joining me, and do join me again. Thank you.
So brightly to The United States ambassador to the UN has vetoed a draft resolution rejecting Donald Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. All 14 other members voted for the resolution. Joining me live on the line now is Caleb Morpin, our correspondent, who's been following events there from his base in New York. Tell us more then about the Security Council meeting. How did the vote unfold and how did they talk about it afterwards?
Well, the 15-member body that leads the United Nations was assembled. Now, the meeting was called by Egypt that put forward a resolution. And this resolution was essentially intended to kind of give voice and give legitimacy to all the outrage that has taken place in response to the announcement from Donald Trump that the United States is moving the U.S. Embassy in Israel to Jerusalem and recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Now, there have been protests all across the world ever since that. There's been a big meeting of Muslim countries from around the world condemning that decision. So the meeting took place. They were discussing and eventually voted on the resolution that came from Egypt. Now, when countries spoke, no one would directly point the finger at the United States or at Donald Trump. However, we did hear some rather strong language. This is Egypt talking about their resolution.
I will address a more... Jerusalem is one of the issues that must be settled through peaceful negotiation between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Any attempt at changing facts on the ground in Jerusalem is considered an illegal unilateral measure that will have no legal impact since it goes against international law.
Now, what made the meeting unique was not only did we hear normal critics of the United States condemning the decision, but we also heard, you know, Western European allies of the U.S., NATO states, condemning this action by the United States and boldly disagreeing with the USA for what took place. This is actually the U.N. ambassador of France.
There are negative effects on the region caused by the December 6th announcement and the way it can be interpreted. These effects must be avoided. We call on all regional players to help calm the situation.
Now, of course, we then heard from Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, and she defended the decision by the White House to move the U.S. embassy. She accused the United Nations of being anti-Israel and called the proposed resolution scandalous. This is Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations.
What we witnessed here today in the Security Council is an insult. It won't be forgotten. It's one more example of the United Nations doing more harm than good in addressing the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Now, under Rule 37 of the United Nations, any country that is affected by a resolution has the right to address the meeting of the Security Council. So we heard from both Israel and Palestine, and the Palestinian representative basically accused the United States of joking with the international community or teasing the international community. Now, at this point, we saw what is a rare occurrence in the UN Security Council chamber. There was a vote among the Security Council that was 14-1, with the entire international community essentially united against the United States. The USA voted against the resolution, and the international community disagreed, almost unanimously. There was a unanimous opposition to the United States in the Security Council. However, it is important to note that because the United States is a permanent member of the UN Security Council, their no vote served as a veto, and the resolution was voted down, despite the fact that all 14 other countries, every other country represented on the Security Council was in disagreement. So at this point, now one thing that was agreed upon by all the bodies, including the United States, was that they wanted peaceful negotiations and a peaceful process to resolve the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Everyone, including the United States, did agree that they wanted a peaceful resolution of the conflict after the resolution that was supported by 14 members and 14 countries was vetoed by the United States.
Bringing us the very latest on today's vote in New York. That's our correspondent there, Caleb Morpin. Thank you.
The Turkish president has been one of the loudest voices. He's now announced plans to open an embassy in East Jerusalem. Maria Finoshna has more on how the Jerusalem move is being confronted.
Here we are in East Jerusalem, the part of the city considered by Palestinians to be their territory. Soon, this status may be supported by Turkey. Now, Ankara has a general consulate here, but the country's president is now saying he wants to open an embassy here.
We've already declared East Jerusalem as the capital of the Palestinian state, but we haven't been able to open our embassy there because Jerusalem is currently under occupation. God willing, we will open our embassy there.
The Turkish leader has been reacting fiercely to Donald Trump's controversial recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, slamming other nations for a weak response. Mr. Erdogan appeared to be speaking on behalf of the Muslim world when he claimed, if we lose Jerusalem, then we won't be able to protect Medina. If we lose Medina, we will lose Mecca and Kaaba. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation held an emergency meeting in Istanbul, where it called on the international community to commit to making East Jerusalem, the Palestinian capital.
We condemn the U.S. decision on Jerusalem because of its great bias against the historical and permanent rights of the Palestinian people in Jerusalem.
The United States' decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel is a dangerous one. It will threaten security and stability and frustrates efforts to resume the peace process.
Every possible step must be taken to prevent the implementation of this illegal action by the U.S. administration. However, there is one question that sticks out here. What factors and elements made it possible for the U.S. president to dare to take such an outrageous act?
And it's not just Muslim nations reacting to the U.S. recognition of Jerusalem. With violent protests all over the globe, the UN Security Council is now reportedly considering a draft resolution to abolish Trump's decision. That's following an emergency session requested by 8 out of the 15 member states. It is highly unlikely that a resolution like this could pass through the Security Council, with America, of course, one of 5 permanent members with veto powers. Marie Finoshna, RT, from Jerusalem.
Well, it could be difficult for Recep Erdogan to carry out the move as the entire city is controlled by Israel, which calls Jerusalem its indivisible capital. It doesn't currently host any foreign embassies. International relations professor Hussein Bagchi believes Erdogan's move has a lot to do with domestic ambitions and his promises to other Muslim states.
Technically, Turkey can do it, but once again, Israel has to permit this. I do not expect that Turkey can do it in the foreseeable future. But Tayyip Erdogan's statement is giving a message for domestic consumption, first of all, and the second one, his promises to the Islamic Organization conference that he wants to get, of course, more countries which could and should recognize East Jerusalem as the capital city of the Palestinian state. But it is not so easy. It is just a promise at the moment to satisfy probably Turkish domestic voters and also give the some hope for the Islamic Conference organization. But I do not expect that Turkey can do it without understanding of Israel.
This is for Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for the answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. No, we live Palestine, no, we live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for the answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. No, we live Palestine.
While we listen to tunes made by ignorant fools, Israel blocked the UN from delivering food. They bring in the troops and you won't even glimpse at the news. They make money off the products that we're quick to consume. And it's not simply a question of differing views. Forget emotions, this is facts, what I spit is the truth. Makes no difference if you're a Christian or if you're a Jew. They're just people living in different conditions to you. They still die when you bomb their schools, mosques and hospitals. It's not because of rockets, please God, can you stop this all? I'm not related to the strangers on the TV, but I relate, cause those strangers could have been me. Words could never ever explain the raw tragedy. It's not a war, they're just murdering more rapidly, and we're automatically supporting pure savagery. Imagine how you feel if this was your family.
Palestine, free 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 Palestine.
Palestine remains in my heart forever. We stand for peace, times of war, we shan't surrender. Remember, it didn't start in this dark December. Every coin is a bullet if you're Marks and Spencer. And when you're sipping Coca-Cola, that's another pistol in the holster of them soulless soldiers. You say you know about the Zionist lobby, but you put money in their pocket when you're buying their coffee. Talking about revolution sitting in Starbucks. The fact is, that's the type of thinking I can't trust, let alone even start to respect. Before you talk, learn the meaning of that scarf on your neck. Forget Nestle, Obama promised Israel 30 billion over the next decade. Their trigger happy and they're crazy. Think about that when you're putting Huggies nappies on your baby.
Free my people.
It's not just a war over stolen land. Why do you think little boys are throwing stones at tanks? And we'll never really know how many people are dead. They drop bombs on innocent girls while they sleep in their bed. Don't get offended by facts, just try and listen. Nothing is more anti-Semitic than Zionism. So please don't bring bad vibes when you speak to me. There's plenty of rabbis that agree with me. It's your choice what you do with this message. Don't get it confused, I view this from a human perspective. How many more resolutions have to be violated? How many more children have to be annihilated? Israel is a terror state, they're terrorists that terrorize. I testify, my television televise, I'm telling lies. This is not a war, it is systematic change. Genocide, but whatever they try, Palestine will never die.
Free my people, long live Palestine. We will never let you go.
Sing it with me now.
Free, free Palestine. 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 Free, free Palestine.
Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza.
This is the story of George Stinney. He was just 14 years old when he was taken by the authorities and charged with a crime. They said that he had killed 11-year-old Betty June Binneker and 8-year-old Mary Emma Thames. This was back in the year 1944. Now, it turns out he did not do any of those things, and just yesterday, he was exonerated. Finally, the state of South Carolina said he didn't do it. We should not have convicted him. But they didn't just convict him, they executed him. Now, I'm going to tell you, unfortunately, about how that happened, because it's important that you know what happened in this country and the remnants of that culture and that history. So first, let's show you George. You got to understand the context here. He was just 90 pounds. He was 5 feet 2. He was 14 years old. They claim that he killed those girls and threw them in a ditch and that he had the capability of doing this. Now, did they have any evidence on him? Well, they had three cops who said he did it and said that he confessed to it. Did they have any witnesses? No. Did they have any physical evidence? No. Did the cops write down the confession at the time? No. Were there any blacks on the jury in South Carolina back in 1944? No. They had a law at the time that said you had to be a voter to be on a jury. But blacks weren't allowed to vote, so they weren't allowed to be on juries. In fact, almost no one there was black at all in the courtroom. 81 days after he was arrested and charged with this, they brought him to trial. The trial lasted about 2.5 hours, during which his white defense attorney, who had not worked a criminal case before and who was going to be running for political office and needed votes in that area, did not present a single defense witness outside of Stinney. He didn't even cross-examine the police. Stinney says that he never confessed. Well, now we know he didn't do the crime. The police bring no evidence except they say, yeah, trust us, he confessed earlier. no cross-examination. The trial lasted 2.5 hours. The jury took 10 minutes to convict him. And then he was led to death row in Clarendon County, South Carolina. We actually have a picture of him being led to death row. Let me show you that. He was carrying a Bible. By the way, just if you're not absolutely clear yet that he didn't do it, historian in 2004 took this case on and investigated it further and found out that there was a wealthy white family in the area who said that the real culprit did a deathbed confession and said that he had killed the two young girls. And a member of that family was part of the process that picked Stinney as the real culprit. It's impossible to know now, looking back 70 years, who knew and didn't know what exactly happened. Really, they were sure that this 14-year-old had done it, this 90-pound 14-year-old. Did they care that someone else had done it and was going to get away with the murders? They didn't care. They strapped him into Old Sparky. That's literally what the electric chair in South Carolina was called. And then, just as the story is horrible, it's about to get worse. Since he was so young, they couldn't strap him in right. They took the Bible he was carrying and made him use it as a booster seat. And then Joy James, an author, writes, the mask covering his face slipped off because the mask didn't fit. It was an adult's mask, revealing his wide-open, tearful eyes and saliva coming from his mouth. The first jolt had not worked. After two more jolts of electricity, the boy was dead. His family was not at the execution. His family was not at the trial. Why? Because they told the family, if you don't leave town immediately, we're going to lynch you all. You want to talk about terror? You know, we talk about terrorism today in America. This was true terror. And they weren't there for their 14-year-old boy. The Associated Press says the rest of the family didn't see the teen again until his funeral, when Stinney's body, burned from the electric chair, was put in an open casket. South Carolina has executed 289 people in the 20th century, and 82% of them were black, according to the Death Penalty Information Center. This legacy is not just about George Stinney and what was done to him. Now, finally, the state of South Carolina says they were wrong. He didn't do it. That legacy continues to this day. Do you know that there were 7 death penalty exonerations? Not in 1944. Today, in the year 2014, 7 people who were set to be executed, and it turned out they didn't do it. Let me show you the pictures of those 7 folks. Yep, 6 out of the 7 just happened to be African American. History rains down on us through the generations. This is not over. In fact, for those guys who were on death row, it took on average 30 years to clear their names. 30 years they sat on death row when they were perfectly innocent. George Stinney was also perfectly innocent, but they needed a scapegoat. And in this country, especially in the South, when they needed a scapegoat, you always knew where they were going to turn. Doesn't mean things haven't gotten better, but we're certainly not at the end of that process. And we've all got to learn from this and work together to make a better system that works for all of us so that we can all proudly call it our justice system. We're not there yet.
There has been a surprising ruling in the case of Michael Slager. He was the former South Carolina police officer who shot and killed Walter Scott as Scott was running away from him. He also lied in the police report about how the incident happened. And later it was very clear that he lied because of the fact that video showed the cop shooting Scott as he was running away. Now, there was a hung jury in the case of Michael Slager. The jurors couldn't come up with a ruling. They couldn't agree on whether or not he was guilty. However, in that case, Slager did plead guilty. He pleaded guilty, I should say, to violating Walter Scott's civil rights. Now, part of that plea agreement, though, indicated that the judge could take a look into the charges involving manslaughter and murder. Now, here's what recently happened. U.S. District Judge David Norton ruled on Thursday today that Slager must serve a prison sentence of between 19 and 24 years for both committing second-degree murder and obstructing justice. So the final ruling was a 20-year prison sentence. The video also directly contradicted Slager's assertion that he only shot Scott because he felt his life was in danger. Now, again, the video that went viral showed that Scott was running away from Slager, and so there was really no reason for him to shoot at Walter Scott 8 times. Go ahead.
So I want to be clear about this. There was the hung jury and a mistrial at the state court, but luckily in this case, because of the violations that Anna talked about, you could bring him to federal court. And in federal court is where he pleaded guilty and now must serve the sentence. And thank God for that. It looked like for a second there, in a series of incredibly egregious police shootings of African Americans, this was arguably the most egregious. And even in that case, we couldn't get a conviction at the state level. But here at the federal level, we have gotten a conviction, and we finally have some degree of justice.
It's so surprising because when the jury could not unanimously find him guilty, it was really a devastating day. I remember feeling so deflated after that and feeling like there was no justice in the country because it was such a clear case. And look, I'm not the only one who thought that. The judge who made this ruling thought that. So Judge Norton said that he had concluded that the killing should be considered murder for the purposes of determining Mr. Slager's punishment. The shooting, he said, was reckless, wanton, and inappropriate.
Well, as you guys saw in the video, the famous video of that incident, he shot Walter Scott in the back as he was running away, made no effort to get him, and then planted evidence next to him. So there was no struggle over the taser. He planted the taser after the shooting. So it was as bad as it gets. It was a wanton murder. So the fact that he's going to get some justice for it is just fantastic, especially when it looked like it was going to be denied. It's not a huge victory. I mean, it is the very least we can get in terms of justice, but at least we got that.
A Minnesota police officer who shot and killed Philando Castile back in July 6th of 2016 has not been convicted of manslaughter. After 27 total hours of deliberation, the jury eventually found him not guilty of involuntary manslaughter. Now, if you don't remember anything about this case, it did happen last year, and Officer Geronimo Yanez pulled over Castile in Falcon Heights, a suburb near Minneapolis and St. Paul, and the officer later said he thought Castile matched the description of a suspect in a recent robbery. Prosecutors ended up charging him with second-degree manslaughter in November, a felony, saying that no reasonable officer would have used deadly force in the same situation. He was also charged with 2 felony counts of intentionally discharging the gun. So he did end up shooting Castile, and what made the story so outrageous was the fact that Philando Castile was a licensed gun owner. During this routine, it wasn't even a routine traffic stop, he was never suspected of a robbery. He was not the suspect at all. But since he fit the description, he was pulled over. He let the officer know, I am a licensed gun owner. There is a gun in the car, and I just want to let you know so there's no problem, right? I'm paraphrasing. I don't know exactly how he said it. And at that point, the cop told him to get his license out. And as he was reaching for his license, that's when the cop shot him 7 times. Now, the video that we're about to show you was filmed by his girlfriend who was in the car, along with her 4-year-old daughter who was in the backseat. Her name is Diamond Reynolds. She started filming a Facebook Live video after the shooting occurred. And it gives you a better sense of what the scene was like. Let's go to video number one.
Stay with me. We got pulled over for a busted tail light in the back. And the police just, he's covered. They killed my boyfriend. He's licensed. He's licensed to carry. He was trying to get out his ID and his wallet out his pocket. And he let the officer know that he was... he had a firearm and he was reaching for his wallet, and the officer just shot him in his arm. We're waiting for a back. I will, sir. No worries. I will. Fuck. He just shot his arm off. We got pulled over on Larpiner.
I told him not to reach for it. I told him to get his hand off
it. You told him to get his ID, sir, and his driver's license. Oh my God, please don't tell me he's dead. Please don't tell me my boyfriend just went like that.
Just keep your hands where they are, please.
Yes, I will, sir. I'll keep my hands where they are. Please don't tell me this, Lord. Please, Jesus, don't tell me that he's gone. Please don't tell me that he's gone. Please, officer, don't tell me that you just did this to him. You shot 4 bullets into him, sir. He was just getting his license and registration, sir.
So the jury did deliberate on this case, and again, they found him not guilty of involuntary manslaughter. Just to give you some more details into how the case played out, one of his colleagues was there with him. He never pulled out a gun. He never shot anyone. However, he did testify that he felt that Yanez followed protocol in the situation and did the right thing. And also, the defense was that Yanez felt threatened. He felt that there was an imminent threat, and as a result, he decided to fire 7 shots. Anyway, so you guys chime in.
First of all, this is just another one, and the tragic thing about this, like you said, when you had to review the story, it happens so much that you have to say, "Oh, which black guy got killed by a cop?" Mm-hmm. Now you have a situation. There's so much here. You have a situation that shows, first of all, if you're black, you look like a suspect.
Yeah.
Period. It doesn't matter tall, small, you know, big, whatever. You're black. You're in a white suburb. You look like a suspect. Then you and right away, you're the most threatening thing the officer's ever seen. I mean, these are police officers. They're not untrained people. They, you know, in other words, like, I'm a big black person. I may scare the average person for no reason, but just because I'm bigger than them. But a police officer's trained to subdue people, to deal with situations. The other thing is, and this shows that when people talk all this crap about compliance and rights and so on, it doesn't apply to black people.
It doesn't. Because
This is a guy who, he was licensed to carry a gun. He said, "I'm licensed to carry a gun. There's a gun in the car." He complied with, he said, "Get your license." So he went for his license, and the cop shot him 7 times, and he's a threat to me. Now, if you're standing outside of a car and the person is sitting in the car, how are they a threat to you? Like, what, you know what I mean? Like, there's physically, what can they do to you? But it doesn't matter. These cases are getting to the point now, and I don't mean this as a joke. I mean this as pain and outrage and anger, that when the cop shoots the person, just give the date of the acquittal. Don't even bother, like, this is when he's going to court, and this is when he'll be acquitted. Every time, it's the same, it's always the same story. The person was threatening. He had superhuman strength. He blah, 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 blah. They fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
It's the same thing over and over. And right now, trust me, as we're talking, there's someone over on Fox News saying what a threat this was and how this guy didn't comply and so on. And you heard the cops still yelling after
and
he killed him.
And still holding his gun, pointing his gun at him and yelling. As he's literally dying in that car right in front of, you know, his girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, and their 4-year-old daughter. And by the way, just this complete lack of consideration for human life, right? It's not only Castile in that car. There's a four-year-old girl in the back seat. And just to give you details on what happened with that situation, according to the complaint, one of Yanez's bullets actually went through the driver's seat and hit the back seat. Reynolds' daughter was sitting in the car seat on the other side of the car, thankfully. Another bullet hit the armrest between Castile and Reynolds. And so it's just, again, this lack of consideration for human lives, right? And to give you even more context, think about the fact that Castile was just one of 963 people who police officers fatally shot in 2016, okay? And so, yes, this disproportionately impacts certain communities like the African-American community. However, it impacts every single one of us if we continuously embolden this type of behavior. And I don't know how anyone can watch that video and not have empathy. I can't watch that video. I actually literally can't look at that video. I have to look down because I don't want to come back in tears while I'm, you know, trying to do, you know, responsible commentary on the story. It's just, if there's no justice, and it's not just this story, it's Tamir Rice, 12-year-old playing with a toy gun, gets shot within 2 seconds of a police officer showing up to the park. Walter Scott, literally running away, he's not posing an imminent threat to the cop, gets shot in the back, and he gets, you know, there's no justice in that case either. I don't know what to say, which is why all of these, you know, solutions of body cams isn't good enough for me, because obviously footage doesn't convince the jury, nothing convinces the jury.
Well, the good thing about, there's nothing good about this in the end, but he got charged. Most often they don't get charged. The prosecutor made a good faith effort, recognized that that does make it stand out. As it says here, officers are rarely charged at all for fatal on-duty shootings, right? I mean, usually we find what happened in Ferguson is the case. This guy got charged. So there was a chance that, some chance that he would get convicted. But the law makes it pretty clear that if a police officer basically says the words, I felt threatened,
right? That's right.
Then, yeah, then it becomes incredibly difficult. At the end of this piece that we're using here, convictions in Freddie Gray, three officers, all of them acquitted. Then they just gave up on the other three because they knew they weren't going to get it. Mistrials were declared last year in two other trials in high-profile shootings. South Carolina, you mentioned Michael Slager, who was acquitted, where the jury was hung, the state trial in Charleston. Then, thankfully, because there were federal charges filed in that case, there could conceivably be federal charges filed here, I suppose. But federal charges were filed in that case, and he's going to prison. And he may go to prison for a long time. We don't know.
For a violation of civil rights.
For a violation
of civil rights. That's what they charge you with. You know, and you're being nice. You're being kind of politically correct on this one. You know, when you talk about it's difficult to get a conviction. No, it's impossible. It doesn't happen.
Right, that's fair.
In Tulsa, you had an officer who was next to one officer who used the taser, right? And this man had his hands up. He was a distance away from her.
That's right.
Far enough away that he would have to run to touch her. In other words, it wasn't like where I'm sitting to you where I could actually reach over and grab. And she killed him and said, I felt threatened.
Right. So,
you know, you're right,
man.
So it's not that it's difficult. Now, when you talk about federal charges, well, now we have a different administration and we have Jeff Sessions as the attorney general. So you can guarantee there will be no federal charges.
That's right.
You're right. Violating the civil rights.
It's just
not going to happen. So it is, it's open season. And this is why when you have someone like a Colin Kaepernick, who is a high profile, you know, football quarterback who speaks out again, they're like, what's he talking about? This, you know, it's like, you said it, Anna, there's zero empathy. There's zero understanding, because if these people who are so, I don't know, I'm not even going to call it pro police, because 98% of the police do a good job. So it's not about that. But the people who refuse to believe that this happens, they can't comprehend that being their son,
right,
or their boyfriend, or their father, or their, you know, somebody that they actually know, because then it becomes real.
Well, I disagree with one thing. I think you're right, we did a story yesterday on the elimination under the Sessions Justice Department of consent decrees, which basically means there's no court oversight for violations in police departments of civil rights. And more importantly, even though it's hard to imagine anything more important than that, in voting rights cases for disenfranchising. They're just, if a state did it for decades, then the Justice Department now, well, you told us you're going to stop and we'll just trust you that you're going to do it. So you're totally right. Where I disagree with you is you guys saying that there's no understanding and empathy. I think there might well be understanding and empathy. My hunch is that at the point we finally talk to those 12 jurors who acquitted him, they're going to say, we ached for it. I wish we could have convicted it, which means that if this is ever going to change, the law has to change. There has to be, first you have to change the training of police officers so that they don't go into that situation presuming that this is the guy. First of all, I would love to see a side by side of if they ever caught that robbery suspect.
Just a quick point to that, by the way. In regard to training, I also want proper vetting of police officials. And I'm not just talking about background checks and things like that. If you are a cop who's easily afraid by people, then you shouldn't be a cop. If you immediately feel threatened just because an individual is black or an individual says that he's licensed to carry and he's warning you ahead of time, you shouldn't be a cop. If you think everything around you is an imminent threat and you're living in a constant state of paranoia, you shouldn't be a cop. There are lots of great cops out there who are brave, who are courageous, right, and who deserve to be cops. But there are also some cops out there who are afraid of everything, who are paranoid, and clearly have certain biases.
Well, you're right. And so we need to, that somehow in this country needs to get fixed. And it needs to get fixed smartly, and it needs to get fixed soon. It's not happening, obviously, in this current climate that we're in right now. But if the law were different, if it wasn't enough to say, I was afraid for my life when there's no video. Walter Slager ended up, not Walter Slager, sorry. What's Slager? Michael Slager. Walter Scott was the innocent man he killed. There's video of the actual shooting. If she'd been rolling on her Facebook thing 20 seconds earlier, we might be in a different situation. But if you change the law and change the training, we might be in a somewhat different situation, a generation from now.
But Ben, the video doesn't matter because there have been numerous videos. We've seen the video.
To be right, we've seen Walter the video. Scott,
I can't breathe. I can't breathe. And if there's six cops on top of you, what more video proof do you need?
I
have a friend who's an officer, and she and I have talked about this, and she said that the big problem is, when you talk about people being fair, a lot of cops are bullies. Mm-hmm. And they get licensed to be a bully. And she said, police need to be more professional. In her department where she works, you have to have a college degree to be a police officer. And she said, one of the things that happens when you go to college is you're exposed to a lot of different people.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking to your point of dealing with other communities, just that experience opens your mind to there are other people. But it's also, she said that in some police departments where you take a high school kid and you send him to training for 6 weeks, and you give him a gun and send him out on the street, something bad's going to happen. Whereas in her department, so the police should be professionals. They should be professionals, and that's what it's going to, because this happened. This is routine. Mm-hmm. Sadly, this is routine.
Yeah. Jenk and I have talked about it for years, and we don't know. We have never been affected by it in the way that JR, who's here, has, and I presume the way that you have. College degree and money. Like, make it a college degree and then pay them well, and make it a worthwhile 20, 25 years that you could put in, because nobody here is going to deny that it's a difficult job and that it's a stressful job. But man, to Anna's point, you got to be able to handle that stress in a professional way. And I know it wears you down. And I know we read about it again and again, that guys come in idealistic and 3-4 years later, A, the system, and B, the ugly circumstances that they see day after day after day wears them down. So there are ways for that too. You mandate psychological counseling. In addition to me paying them $80,000 a year and making sure that they have a college degree, you get 10 weeks off. I don't know. You get time to cool down and blow up. I don't know what
mandatory
it is.
Mandatory self-care, right?
Right. But we gotta, because it's, you did. You're right. We saw it coming. And maybe you're right. Maybe if that video had been rolling 20 seconds later, maybe it wouldn't have made any difference. But it is significant that with Michael Slager, where we saw a gun discharged and in federal court, his lawyer knew, everybody knew, this is going to be a different case when we get into federal court. And it's a civil rights case and not a case where just saying, hey, I was scared is going to be enough.
Because black minds matter. Her name is distinctly and deliciously black. A young scholar named Gyanga Yamata Taylor has recently authored a book that promises to open eyes as well as minds. It's titled, From Hashtag Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, put out last year from Haymarket Book in Chicago. In it, Taylor examines the violent impunity of the cops and their racist disdain for black life, the very thing sparked black rebellions across 20th century, from Watt in California to Overtown in Florida. She charted the explosive growth of the Black Lives Matter movement and related organizations nationally. She also gives a failing grade to black politicians, for many of them had no idea how to respond to one of the most pressing problems facing black people, police terror. Her critique of black politicians show that they differ little from their white predecessors except for their color. For Professor Taylor, few so-called black political leaders, many of whom signed on the mass incarceration train engineered by Bill Clinton, get a pass. Her work is thoughtful, honest, critical, and insightful. She does great credit to the scholar's art. Several years ago, law professor Michelle Alexander rocked the house with her remarkable book, The New Jim Crow. Now, it's Gyanga Yamata Taylor's turn. From hashtag Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation from Haymarket. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Hi, welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay. We're continuing our series titled Undoing the New Deal. While most of the measures taken during the New Deal helped to mitigate the worst effects of the Depression on workers and create a social safety net where there had been none before, not all Americans benefited equally. Most New Deal programs discriminated against African Americans. Whites were offered the first jobs, and it allowed a separate and lower pay scale for blacks. This is in a federal government jobs program. The Federal Housing Authority refused to guarantee mortgages for blacks who tried to buy in white neighborhoods. And the Civilian Conservation Corps maintained segregated camps. The Social Security Act excluded those job categories blacks traditionally filled. Situation in agriculture was even worse. Since 40% of all black workers made their living as sharecroppers and tenant farmers, the Agricultural Adjustment Administration acreage reduction hit blacks hard. That is, in this program, farmers are actually paid not to produce food, which raised the prices for farmers. But white landlords could make more money by leaving land untilled than by putting land back into production, which created even more black unemployment. In the 1960s, New Deal-style programs were created that benefited blacks more equally. But successive administrations, both Democratic and Republican, have been rolling back these programs since the 1980s. Bill Clinton's welfare reforms played a major role in undoing the New Deal, and now the Republican Party is planning to put a few final nails in the coffin of what's left. Now joining us to discuss African Americans and the New Deal is Gerald Horn. Gerald is the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's the author of many books, most recently The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance, and The Origins of the United States of America. Thanks for joining us again, Gerald.
Thank you for inviting me.
So let's start with the New Deal itself. We know that blacks simply did not benefit from the New Deal programs in the way white workers did. Why don't we start with that? What are some examples of that? And then we can kind of get into the why and the politics of it.
Well, you alluded to a number of the examples, that is to say, with regard to the Social Security program seeking to exclude categories of workers where blacks tended to flock, such as agricultural labor in particular. I should also mention that with regard to housing programs, recent scholarship has suggested that New Deal housing programs did not erode Jim Crow neighborhoods. They helped to fortify Jim Crow neighborhoods. However, before we go too far in that direction, I should also mention some of the positive benefits of the New Deal, particularly the so-called Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act, which was kind of Magna Carta for organizing of the industrial North and the industrial Midwest. This led to the formation of the United Auto Workers, United Steel Workers in particular, and they tended to organize many black workers within their ranks. And then after those unions were organized, they were able to use the dues money of those workers to support anti-Jim Crow initiatives. So in some ways, it's fair to say that the New Deal was a mixed bag for African Americans.
And in those unionization struggles, many blacks were in the leadership of those struggles. Some of the bitter fights founding the UAW and some of the industrial unions, black workers were right up front leading the struggle.
Not only with regard to the United Auto Workers, United Steel Workers, but keep in mind that at that point, there was a flourishing, mostly black union, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Workers, led by A. Philip Randolph, who started off as a left-wing socialist and then migrated into a kind of right-wing social democrat. But in between, that is to say in the 1930s, his union, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Workers, was a very important force, not only in terms of organizing black workers on the railroads, which then, before the era of air travel, was the major route for transcontinental travel in this country, but also in more mundane tasks. For example, in terms of spreading anti-Jim Crow propaganda in the dankest precincts of Dixie. Oftentimes that propaganda was spread. By propaganda, I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, I just mean literature. that literature was spread through Jim Crow, through Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Worker porters who were traveling, say, from New Orleans to Houston or from Houston to Dallas. So this union drive is really one of the unsung heroes of the whole progressive movement in this country.
Now, with much of the legislation, New Deal legislation, the jobs I mentioned, jobs went to white workers first. There was a lower separate pay scale. We're talking jobs in the federal jobs program where the federal government hired millions of people. There were other programs that discriminated against blacks. There was some exception. Apparently, Harold Ickes, who was in the cabinet, put a lot of money into black schools in the South. But generally speaking, Roosevelt did not want to take on the Dixiecrats, the white racist members of the Democratic Party that controlled much of the legislatures in the South and also represented much of the representation in Congress. Apparently, there's even an anti-lynching law that Roosevelt didn't want to support. The politics of the period, and Roosevelt gets a lot of critique for this, that he didn't take them on because they would have blocked his New Deal legislation, was his fear. What do you make of the critique? I guess part of what I'm asking is, given the real politics of the day, did he have a choice or not?
Well, it's complicated. I mean, look at the party configuration coming out of the U.S. Civil War, that is to say, post-1865. You have the Republican Party, the party of abolition, the party of Abraham Lincoln, the party that the great abolitionist Frederick Douglass says is the ship and all else is the sea. And the Republican Party is basically comprised of black male voters in Dixie and white middle class and white elite forces in the North. And then you have the Democratic Party, which is basically comprised of white workers in the South and white workers in the North. Obviously, that's a screwy political configuration. Now, beginning in 1932, you began to see a mass defection of black voters to the Democratic Party, driven by the Great Depression and the inertia of the Herbert Hoover administration that preceded the administration of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But when black workers started flooding into the Democratic Party in 1932 and 1936, they did not necessarily receive a warm greeting from their fellow white workers. And in fact, one of the reasons why the New Deal programs were so stingy with regard to coverage of black interests and coverage of black workers was precisely because of this antipathy from the Dixiecrats. Now, the question is, could Franklin Delano Roosevelt have done more? I think that's a fair question, but I think that objectively speaking, like political leaders before and since, he was faced with a rock-solid granite wall of white supremacy within the ranks of his own party, and that is a force that is very difficult to overcome.
And so he's left with the choice that if he wants this kind of New Deal, kind of social democratic legislation, he can't take on the South, the Dixiecrats, and has to essentially concede to a certain amount of discriminatory practices.
Well, I'm sure you recall the discourse in this country in the last 8 to 9 years when it was often cited this remark that was made by FDR, President Roosevelt, where he challenges unions and progressive forces to make him move in a progressive direction. That was cited, of course, when we were confronting President Barack Obama. And I think that if you understand that particular conversation, you'll understand that despite the fact that the left was rising in the United States in the 1930s, the Communist Party was at its zenith. It had a membership of about 80,000 in 1938. The Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, as already noted, was also ascending. It had organized the auto workers and the steel workers and the rubber workers in Akron, Ohio. But having said all of that, they were still not powerful enough to overcome the rock-solid Jim Crow that is part of the mother's milk of the politics of the United States of America.
Well, in this series we've been doing with historian Peter Kuznick and now Gerald, and we may introduce some other historians. The sort of theme is you have this New Deal, Roosevelt's New Deal, which has mostly to do with the capitalist crisis. It's an alternative to the European response, which was fascism. It's also a way to try to prevent a strengthening of the socialist and communist movement in the United States and save the capitalist system to mitigate the worst of the crisis on American workers. That social safety net that gets created starts to get eroded. Peter Kuznick says as early as 39-40, even Roosevelt seems to lose some of his commitment to it. There's a proposal for a universal health care, which Roosevelt does not support. Then with the overthrow of Wallace as vice president, he does not become the next president. You have Truman. The next big beats in terms of the New Deal, am I right to say the next big beat is in the 1960s, where Johnson's War on Poverty actually builds on the New Deal and extends it within, you could say, the midst of the civil rights movement and a massive mass movement demanding reform and civil rights for African Americans. So talk a bit about that, and then we can kind of talk about what happened to all of this legislation.
Well, certainly the 1960s was a turning point in terms of trying to construct a social safety net in this country. It was not only the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which helped to erode some of the more egregious aspects of Jim Crow. Perhaps more important was the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which not only granted the right to vote to many blacks in Dixie, but also granted the right to vote to so-called language minorities. That is to say that ballots could now be printed in Spanish, ballots could now be printed in Chinese languages, and this helped to open the door to more ethnic and racial minorities getting the right to vote. And in turn, they were able to elect more progressive representatives who in turn were able to enact programs like the National Endowment for the Arts or PBS, the Public Broadcasting System, and more aid to education, for example, and also more legislation with regard to fighting housing bias and housing discrimination. But as we know, there was a counter-revolution beginning in 1980, that is to say in August 1980, when Ronald Wilson Reagan kicks off his campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, site of the place where three civil rights workers were slain tragically in 1964, this sends a signal to Dixie that the bad old days, from our point of view, are back, and that leads to a counter-revolution, a counter-reaction from 1980 to 1988.
Before we get into Reagan, just a little more on some of the legislation from the 60s. Like, if I'm correct, food stamps comes out of the legislation of the 1960s. I think there's an expansion or strengthening of Social Security.
Medicare, Medicaid.
Yeah, go on.
Yes. Well, as noted, food stamps come out of the 1960s, and I have to say, as like many starving graduate students, I utilized food stamps when I was attending graduate school. But also Medicare and Medicaid come out of the 1960s. Medicare is part of this step-by-step expansion of health security, Medicare basically applying to those who are considered to be senior citizens, and then Medicaid, which applies to those who are below a certain poverty line. And this was a tremendous step forward, and as we know, in 2018, they're going to be on the chopping block.
Is it fair to say what I said in the introduction, that these reforms of the 1960s were more equitable to black Americans than the New Deal of the 30s?
Well, yes, I think it's only because of the different era. That is to say that the 1960s witnessed a tremendous erosion of the walls of Jim Crow and bigotry. The walls of Jim Crow and bigotry, as already noted, helped to prevent the expansion of New Deal programs in the 1930s. But with the erosion of the 1960s, it was possible to have a more equitable distribution, if you like, with regard to food stamps, for example. So certainly the 1960s were a great leap forward in terms of the fight against racism and bigotry.
So Reagan kicks off a real energized campaign to undo the New Deal, undo the reforms of the 60s. We're going to trace this forward, to Clinton and beyond. But why do you think this takes place?
Sorry, I missed that.
I said, why do you think Reagan and it comes to power and is able to start undoing New Deal and 1960s legislation?
Well, first of all, contrary to popular opinion, there was no unanimity with regard to the Voting Rights Act of 1965 or the Civil Rights Act of 1964. There were many in Dixie who felt that by uplifting black workers, these white workers were being faced with stiffer competition, and that was the grist for the mill of the counter-revolution ignited by Ronald Wilson Reagan. As well, Ronald Reagan was buoyed by the international gust then prevailing. That is to say, there was still a lot of anger and resentment over the U.S. defeat suffered in Indochina in April 1975 with the defeat in the Vietnam War. There was significant support in this country, not only for the Cold War, but for the underlying premises of the Cold War, which was supposedly the idea that government was taking too strong a role in the economy as represented by the most diabolical view of socialism. And that helped to propel a counterattack against government-sponsored programs, against the social safety net. And keep in mind as well that for many in Dixie, it was the federal government in Washington, D.C. that pushed through the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And as President Johnson acknowledged at the time, this would cause many white voters in Dixie to defect from the Democratic Party, which they promptly did.
These are the Reagan Democrats.
Well, not only that, but many of them switched en masse from the Democratic Party to voting for the GOP. And then, of course, you had this major third party movement led by Governor George Wallace of Alabama, which got double digits with regard to a race for the presidency in 1968. So I think it would be a mistake to underestimate the depth and persistence of mass opposition to anti-Jim Crow measures.
And this creates the conditions for Reagan. Let me add one thing to that. It's also the time of the real expansion of globalization and the ability of companies to offshore production and really undermine the strength of American workers.
Oh, clearly. I mean, this is the era, for example, when U.S. relations with apartheid South Africa are tightening. Keep in mind that apartheid South Africa had plants from General Motors and from Ford in Port Elizabeth, South Africa, on the Indian Ocean coast. This is also the era, that is to say, in 1971, when President Richard M. Nixon brokers his entente with China, which leads to runaway plants from the United States to low-wage havens in China, which, of course, has now backfired and created this juggernaut with consequences that are rather now still difficult to estimate. So certainly, U.S. workers were whipsawed during the 1960s, 1970s, and beyond, not only by these runaway shops that I've already made reference to, but for a certain class of white workers in Dixie, they felt that they were being subjected to unfair competition from black workers who were being backed by the federal government in terms of their own struggle against Jim Crow measures.
Okay. In part two of this series with Gerald, I think it's part five in terms of the overall series. So the next one will be six, I guess. Okay, I'm getting mixed up on the parts, but I think this one's five and the next one's six of Undoing the New Deal. We're going to continue the discussion of what happens with Reagan, but we're going to relatively quickly get to Bill Clinton's role in undoing the New Deal. So please join us for the continuation of this series on the Real News Network. Don't forget.
We'll be right back. skin. Run, 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 but you sure can't hide. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Vote for me and I'll set you free. Rap on, brother, rap on. Well, the only person talking about love now, brother, is the preacher. And it seems nobody's interested in learning but the teacher. Segregation, determination, demonstration, integration, aggravation, divinity, obligation to my nation. Control the sound of soul, shooting rockets to the moon, kids going up to Zoom. Politicians say more taxes will solve everything.
And the band played on.
Round and around and around we go. Where the world's at, except nobody knows.
Come to the midpoint in today's program. This is Wake Up Call on Radio Justice. Please stay tuned as we end this upcoming segment with the late Professor Amos Wilson.